From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us this week. As you've no doubt read in the news and heard here on WPR and other places, Afghan refugees have been coming to Fort McCoy in our listening area near Toma over the last several weeks, and we're here for an update today. We've got several different parts of that conversation for you. We'll hear from Team Rubicon later, which is coordinating a lot of the physical resources that those people need. But joining me right now is WPR reporter Hope Kerwin, a familiar voice to listeners of this program. Hope, welcome back to Newsmakers.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been covering the story of these people from Afghanistan leaving their country, in many cases leaving family and others behind, and coming here to through a series of stops, ultimately ending up here at Fort McCoy in the middle of Wisconsin. How many Afghan refugees were brought to Fort McCoy? And that's I know already, that's a tricky question.
Yeah, so we don't actually know how many refugees are at Fort McCoy right now. The officials started giving periodic updates when refugees first started arriving, but they changed their policy about 2 weeks ago to no longer provide exact numbers. So the last update we received was Friday, September 3rd, when just under 9,000 refugees were at the base. They have a max capacity of 13,000 people. And when I spoke with officials at the fort, it sounded like they expected to need that space. So they're likely around that number. But it will likely fluctuate as people begin to kind of finish the paperwork process that they're under and start to kind of move on to the next step.
The population of Fort McCoy fluctuates anyway because of various trainings that start and end and all of these different situations that come up there. As far as you know, are these refugees being housed in existing facilities, or are they like putting up special facilities for them? Or
yeah, so the evacuees are staying at the barracks that they typically use for military personnel there, and so they are being housed as family units in these different facilities. They're kind of like open dormitories. Each building houses about 30 people, and they're kind of leaving it up to families to kind of put up any temporary barriers if they would like to kind of create personal space. They're also then, you know, people who are arriving as individual males or females, they're housing then those people separately, but they're able to keep the families together for the most part.
So what kind of services are they? Obviously, they're going to feed them and things like that, but what are these people experiencing as they come to Fort McCoy?
Yeah, so federal officials described what's happening at Fort McCoy and other bases throughout the U.S. as reception centers. So what they're doing is going through whatever immigration paperwork they need. People are kind of arriving in a broad spectrum of places in the immigration system. So perhaps they had already started applying for a visa when they were in Afghanistan and weren't able to complete that process before needing to be evacuated, or maybe they hadn't even started. So they're kind of having to address each person's case individually. Federal officials haven't said exactly what that process looks like, but I did hear from a refugee resettlement agency that they heard part of it is expediting people's work authorization documents, so that way when they leave the base, they will be able to easily apply for employment in the U.S. They're already authorized to work in the U.S., but they'll have all the documents in hand when they leave the base. They're also going through a medical screening and getting any immunizations that they need as part of the immigration process. We also know that they're being offered the COVID-19 vaccine. And from what I've heard from, officials who've been briefed there, it sounds like almost all of them have gotten the vaccine. And then they're also getting humanitarian assistance while they're there. I've heard from people providing services that most people are walking off those planes with maybe a one bag for their family of personal items or just the clothes on their back. So most people don't have anything and they're kind of having to start over. So groups like the American Red Cross, Catholic Charities out of the Diocese of La Crosse, and the nonprofit you mentioned, Team Rubicon, they're organizing donations, things like clothing, toiletries, but also things like a backpack to hold those items in, bug spray, sunscreen, you know, just the things you kind of need to get through day to day. Also, we know that a large number of the people there are children. I heard from one volunteer that they estimate about 30 or about a third of the people there are children. And so they also need things like coloring books and soccer balls because kids are kids.
Yeah, I can't imagine being a child and being uprooted from the only life you've ever known and thrust into this situation. It's just amazing, and the effort that's going into caring for these people is equally amazing. The logistics are just mind blowing. How many different organizations are trying to work together? And maybe you don't have a definitive answer to that, but like, how many organizations have you heard of that are working together to get those needs met?
So those three organizations, the American Red Cross, Catholic Charities, Team Rubicon, they're kind of the main groups that are working on the base. And I also know that there are nine non-governmental organizations that provide refugee resettlement, and so across the U.S., and so they're going to be potentially working with these folks. The one thing is that, you know, I heard from Catholic Charities that they had a lot of people, you know, wanting to volunteer or work with folks, but they found it very difficult to kind of get volunteers onto the base because obviously Fort McCoy is a military installment, and so there are installation, and they're very protective of kind of who comes on and off the base. And so it's not as easy as kind of rounding up volunteers for an afternoon.
Yeah, there's you can't just show up at the gate.
No, not at all.
You mentioned several organizations, but I wanted to especially point out that that Catholic Charities. You did get a chance to talk to Catholic Charities at length, and a woman named Karen Becker from Catholic Charities. We're going to hear from her a little bit later in the show. What kind of screening process have these evacuees gone through to finally arrive at Fort McCoy? I know they came to the airport in Afghanistan. They were evacuated out of the airport to another place like overseas before they even came into the U.S., and then they all landed in the U.S. somewhere else before coming to Wisconsin.
Yeah, so it's definitely there's no direct flights from Kabul to Volk Field. So,
yeah, right.
State Department officials explained the process to me in that they are going to an intermediate site is how they described it. A lot of those people are going to Qatar or Germany and being screened there. Once they go through that screening, they arrive at a major U.S. airport, most of them Dulles in Washington, D.C. And at that point, that's when they are officially kind of entered into the immigration process and given what's called humanitarian parole into the country. So that is a legal status that allows them to be there. And then from that point, then they're flown into Volk Field and bused to Fort McCoy. So by the time they reach Fort McCoy, they already hold the legal status of humanitarian parolee, and they've already been screened multiple times.
So I was going to ask about that status. Humanitarian parole is what it's called. And then there's more paperwork that's going on. And you were talking about them being able to, you know, when they leave the base, be able to seek employment right away. But what are these going to be like regular permanent, I guess green card is the term everybody's familiar with. Are these going to be regular visa holders in the U.S. after all this is said and done?
So that is one of the questions that is still kind of yet to be unanswered by Congress in part, and also the State Department is working to figure that out. So I spoke with a refugee resettlement agency called the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. So they're one of those NGOs that works across the U.S. to they're contracted by the State Department to settle refugees that come to the country. And so one of the questions that I discussed with someone who works for this organization is that humanitarian parole is not a very common immigration status for people. And mm-hmm. so it's a little unclear what services and benefits these folks will be able to access, because it's not kind of the typical refugee status that people have and then go through the resettlement process. So that is one of the questions that's kind of out there. Some of the folks perhaps were applying for what's called a special immigration visa, which is specifically for people who worked for the U.S. military in Afghanistan, maybe as an interpreter or translator. There's also a program called P2 or Priority 2 that's really for people who worked for like U.S. nonprofits or U.S. media organizations. So there are folks who maybe are going through that track, but the vast majority of people are arriving under that humanitarian parole, and it's a little unclear kind of what their next steps will be, you know, how long it will take for them to apply for a green card or legal permanent residency or U.S. citizenship. So that's one of the things that Congress has to decide. There has been legislation introduced, but it's likely going to come through the budget process because that tends to move a little quicker. And it's something that the State Department is also working on.
You talked about the government contractors that have got people who have been of some assistance to our military, either as translators or you know, logistical help or whatever. Is that what most of the people who are here are, or who are the people who are coming?
Yeah. So federal officials have not provided a lot of details about who people are, and they've been very protective about no images of people being shared. Because there is some concern that, you know, people's families who are still in Afghanistan or friends could be identified. And so they've been kind of protective of that information. We do know that, you know, some of the folks fall into those categories. Most are arriving as families, so maybe one of their immediate family fell into that category, and so then their children or their spouse is also with them. I also know that there's, you know, female students from the American University of Afghanistan there. So, you know, it's kind of a wide variety of folks, but we don't have a lot of details of, like, how many fit into this category and how many fit into that category.
I know our listeners are interested in this subject, and yet when they hear that we don't have answers to some of these questions, it's tempting to think, well, why don't you just go ask? Well, we often do. Talk about some of the hurdles that commonly come up when you're reporting on a story like this that make it more difficult than one might think to get answers to what on the surface seem like simple questions.
Well, anytime you're asking the federal government a question, it sometimes takes a long time to get the answer to that, especially when every reporter in the country wants to know the answers to those questions a lot of times. Also, you know, as I said, I think federal officials have been very hesitant to provide a lot of information because they're trying to protect people. You know, obviously, if they were evacuated from Afghanistan and are getting to this point, they were deemed as in danger by the Taliban. And, you know, we know that not everybody was able to be evacuated. And so I think they're just being really cautious. And that's definitely been a huge barrier. Also, like we talked about before, with Fort McCoy being a military base, they're obviously very careful about who can come on and off that base and who can kind of find out information about operations there. And so that's another barrier.
You talked about the evacuees from Afghanistan having access to the COVID-19 vaccine and how many of them are getting it. What else is being done to take care of the health concerns? I read the other day that there was a case of measles that had come. Are they being offered the same slate of vaccines that members of our general public usually have?
Yeah, so part of that, you know, they are receiving a full medical screening as part of their immigration process. And so they do have access to or are in some cases required to get certain immunizations for as part of the immigration process. They did confirm that there was one. Part of Wisconsin's congressional delegation received a briefing and then spoke to reporters. And through that, they provided information that there was one measles case and they had to isolate some people who were obviously close contacts of that person, but they only had one confirmed case. They also said that they're doing periodic testing of the folks at Fort McCoy for COVID-19, and they have identified a few positive cases, but they didn't provide a specific number of cases, but said there was a very small number confirmed. But they also mentioned that, you know, for the most part, people are getting the vaccine.
So it's safe to say that's all underway. And the measles case in particular, people worry about something like that. That was an isolated incident, and their medical treatment is seemingly in good hands.
Yeah. So we do know that they're being provided medical care by Department of Defense staff, so it could be local military staff or other folks that have been brought in. They also, in a few cases where folks have needed more acute care, they have said that they've transported some of the evacuees to local hospitals to receive care and then brought them back to the base. And so I think that we'll probably see more local medical providers kind of stepping in to provide that care. I do know that, you know, these folks, as they are living here, you know, over the next coming weeks, you know, obviously they're going to need the same kind of human care that everybody else needs. I know that a few of the women are pregnant, that, you know, some of the volunteers said they saw pregnant women. So it's like, you know, people, they're humans and they have the same kind of medical needs and other kinds of needs that everybody else does.
Speaking of those needs, everybody wants to help. There have been all kinds of drives for, you know, clothes and different items that are needed. And yet there are some items that are not needed and less helpful. And that list, as Karen from Catholic Charities will outline in our next segment, that's an ever-changing list. What can people do who want to help?
Yeah, so Karen from Catholic Charities told me that they just have received, you know, a constant flow of donations, really, since it was first announced that we were going to see refugees coming to Wisconsin, which has been so great. But, you know, they have limited volunteers. And so they have been kind of careful to say, you know, we don't need any more donations at this time. So I really would suggest people check their Facebook page or their website. Obviously, monetary donations are something that these organizations will continue to need as they continue to provide assistance in the coming weeks and months. That has been something that I've seen multiple organizations kind of call for. You know, Catholic Charities is looking for people who would be willing to give a week or two of their time to consistently volunteer, just because it does take time to do the kind of needed background checks to get on the base. And, you know, that's been kind of the local organizations. Just this week, we did see a new national effort pop up called Welcome.us, and it is been kind of endorsed by former President Bill Clinton, former President George Bush, and former President Barack Obama. And so that group is kind of helping coordinate things on a national level. They're looking for folks who are willing to donate. They're looking for folks who are willing to be a sponsor to refugees, the thousands of people who are going to be finding a new home here in the U.S. You know, they're partnering with organizations like Airbnb because they're anticipating they're not going to be able to find housing for all of these folks right away, and they might have to move to a temporary situation like an Airbnb or hotel. So there's definitely lots of resources online that I would point people to.
You said not a lot is known about next steps for these people. How long could it be before we see some of them actually living in our communities and not just located at a base near our communities?
Yeah, so that is a little unclear. State Department officials have said they're hoping to get people through the needed paperwork process in 14 to 21 days. It's been about that time since the first folks have arrived, someone described it as building the plane while it's in the air a little bit. And I think that it's taken a little bit longer for them to figure out the most efficient way to get people through the system. So I think we have seen a few folks leave Fort McCoy who were either American citizens or already legal permanent residents of the U.S. And so, you know, a few of those folks have left. And I think as people kind of make connections with, if they have family and friends already in the U.S., they'll likely be able to be resettled with their loved ones, you know, more quickly. But, you know, when I spoke with the Refugee Resettlement Agency, you know, she said that they've only, you know, resettled one family so far, and they are really not, you know, they're kind of expecting folks to start coming through the system in the next 2 weeks.
Interesting indeed. Hope Kerwin is a reporter with WPR. She's based here in La Crosse, has been doing some reporting out at Fort McCoy and on this issue of people from Afghanistan coming to our community as they've had to flee their own country. Hope, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Thank you.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, we've teased it a couple of times. Karen Becker from Catholic Charities had a chance to talk with Hope, and we'll hear from Karen about the situation there at Fort McCoy from a charity perspective and what people can do to help and how they can get involved. As always, you can reach out to the program by sending us an email. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Afghan refugees being resettled here in the United States. They've temporarily arrived at Fort McCoy and are being taken care of there. We've heard from Hope Kerwin, and now Hope had a conversation with Karen Becker from Catholic Charities of the Diocese of La Crosse. They serve some 19 counties in our area, and they've been really doing a great job working with our new guests from Afghanistan at Fort McCoy. And first off, Karen Becker tells Hope why Catholic Charities is so well positioned to serve.
Here at Catholic Charities, I've always said that's one of the best things about Catholic Charities is that we have the ability with our programming to recognize where there's a need and to address that need, and our staff is ready and willing to jump in and provide this service. This is an amazing community, very generous community as far as monetary donations, in-kind things, and volunteerism. So when I had our immigration department knew that they potentially would be called in once Fort McCoy potentially would be a site where the Afghanistan refugees would be housed. That was probably the first program that we knew could be affected by this, and I just thought, this is in the heart of our diocese. We Catholic Charities here in the Diocese of La Crosse serves 19 counties, and Fort McCoy is kind of in the center of where we're at. And with our past history of how we reach out to people and answer the call, I knew that there would be a big need. You know, initially, Governor Evers talked about that they would be stationed at Fort McCoy, that there could be over 10,000 folks stationed. We don't know how long. I mean, it was so random at first that we just knew that we had the capability, or this is what we do. These are folks that served, helped our military, that were there for us in a foreign land, and now they were fleeing and needed to be cared for. And we at Catholic Charities consider ourselves the hands and feet and hearts of Christ. And we are called to serve with human dignity.
That's Karen Becker from Catholic Charities of La Crosse. She also talked about the setup there at Fort McCoy and what it looks like.
Our buildings are kind of in the heart of a certain community. So we've gotten what we've called neighborhoods. We've been given 5 one-story centers that on one half have a place where we have children doing coloring activities, playing chess. There's a door that leads right out to picnic tables so they can also take activities out. We've got soccer ball fields that we're getting ready to set up. One building happens to be already by a large grassy area, so they can go out and kick balls around. But then the upper area, we've created kind of an area for women and small children. The civilian end of Fort McCoy has been great in helping us stock these. So we do have large TVs set up with DVD players where we can play cartoons. It kind of is a respite area for women to come in. It happens organically. A lot of times we don't know what's going to be popular or what the women might be needing. And it was absolutely amazing one day when I was there last week. A volunteer just randomly brought in 3 brand new sewing machines. She herself is a seamstress, and we know that clothing is one of the things that women and children and men out there will be needing. Their attire is sometimes different than what we in America wear. As we're trying to solve it in our typical fashion, like, where can we get this? Here comes this woman with 3 sewing machines, and I watched that afternoon in an hour and a half as one of the Afghanistan women sits down, and without a pattern, without any measuring tape, just fits another woman in a long-sleeved, knee-length garment that fit her beautifully. And she did it in an hour and a half. And all of a sudden, we realize that there is this amazing group of Afghanistan women who are very talented seamstresses who would love the activity of being able to sew for children, for others, as colder weather comes on. And so we have a group that we had a volunteer and a group that we are affiliated with the Madison and Milwaukee area. That is another seamstress group that has now collected like 8,000 yards or more of fabric that they're bringing in, and more sewing machines that they're bringing in. I hate, to be quite honest, to even let people know that we're doing this, because the minute this community, our communities here in Wisconsin, hear that there's a need, they fill it faster than, I mean, it'll be filled 5 times over.
Karen Becker of Catholic Charities in La Crosse talked with WPR's Hope Kerwin. She talked about how Catholic Charities' role is going to shift and change as the needs of the new population changes.
I have been forwarding, as I receive information, I let people know that our agency is not engaged right now with refugee resettlement. And as we become aware of organizations that are, to continue to watch our website, because I will put resources up as we become aware of those resources. And then I think as we see refugees who are, or Afghanistan guests at Fort McCoy who are settled into our communities and become our neighbors, we will definitely be a resource for any supplies we have left, any funding that people donate to us. Again, I said it's been a very generous community. So if we move the refugees into an organization or with an organization or get settled in one of our communities and the donations that we received have not yet all been expensed, then they would transfer, those funds would be transferred into purchasing items, maybe to set up an apartment or to pay a first month's rent. So that's where I see the connection happening. We don't have the professional expertise at this point needed to know all the legals and ins and outs, but we do have the community contacts to help them find employment. We have a St. Lawrence program here that can help with housing counseling or housing resources across the diocese. So I think we'll continue to be there as needed. As I said earlier, you know, when we see there's a mission, we try to fill it as best we can. But we also we don't want to duplicate services if there's somebody already doing it. It's not cost effective. So we'll offer support and any financial resources we continue to have. But we'll turn them over to the professionals, to the folks who do resettlement.
That's Karen Becker from Catholic Charities here in La Crosse, and she spoke with WPR's Hope Kerwin. Coming up on Newsmakers, the organization that's running logistics for the donation process at Fort McCoy, Team Rubicon. We'll hear from them. That's coming up next. If you'd like to hear part of our show that you might have missed, you can find it online. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. Or if you have a question or comment to pass along, maybe an idea for a future show, you can email us, newsmakers@WPR.org. That's newsmakers@WPR.org. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. We've been talking about the guests that are in our community from Afghanistan at Fort McCoy, more specifically. We've heard a number of things. Our reporter Hope Kerwin earlier gave us an update on some of her reporting. We've heard from Catholic Charities. And now we turn to John Stuhlmacher from Team Rubicon, which is an organization that's coordinating a lot of the humanitarian needs that are being met there at Fort McCoy for the evacuees from Afghanistan. John, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So we'll get into the specifics of your organization and how long it's been around and what you do a little bit later as our conversation goes on. But in terms of these evacuees who have been arriving and who are now staying for the time being at Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin, what services are you offering to these people? What are you accomplishing through your presence there at McCoy?
So Team Rubicon was asked to step in and lead the donations management aspect of this operation. In the disaster world, which is one we're comfortable in, donations management is actually often called the disaster after the disaster, where you get a lot of donations you can't use and you don't get the ones you can. So Team Rubicon decided that we could fulfill this need and step up and really take a wraparound approach to the disaster donations management. So we're doing everything from reaching out to organizations, individuals, and corporations with an ask of what we need. And then we are taking in that donation, separating it, and then handing it off to our partners at the State Department, where they have an actual store set up on Fort McCoy, where the Afghan evacuees can come in and shop for free for items that they need. And they bring them through about 50 at a time and keep cycling them through till we'll get everyone what they need.
So what kinds of needs are the people arriving at Fort McCoy with? I know just anecdotally through some communications that I've had, I know some arrive having left everything behind. Some arrive having been able to bring some clothing and other things. What are the most pressing needs?
So the vast majority were not allowed to bring anything with them when they evacuated. That was so that they could expedite the evacuations, you know, without having to do extensive bag searches, and so they could get more people on the aircraft. So the majority of these evacuees have come with only the clothes on their back. They've been in these same clothes for quite some time now. So the biggest need is getting them culturally appropriate changes of clothing. That sounds easy, but when you look at the size of a population that we're dealing with, this is a monumental effort that really requires all of not just Western Wisconsin, but the whole state of Wisconsin stepping in to support it. And I can't say enough how well Wisconsinites have stepped up to support this mission.
Talk a little bit about that term you used, culturally appropriate. What do you mean by that?
So for women particularly, we want to make sure that they have something that they're comfortable wearing. In their culture, they primarily wear long pants or long dresses that go all the way down to their feet, long sleeves, and, you know, tighter necklines. We also want to make sure that for religious reasons, you know, that we have hijab and headscarves available for the women. The men are also usually wearing long pants and long sleeves. And even though it's a pretty nice fall right now here, for a lot of these individuals, it's very cold. So we want to try and get them some of the warmer clothes that we may not be wearing yet. But if you look ahead and say, what would I be wearing next month? That's definitely what they want right now.
So in terms of the donations that you receive, you said you receive the donations, you go through them. What do you see that maybe, you know, not that you don't appreciate the good intentions of people. What do you see too much of? What do you see that you don't really need any more of?
We really don't need used clothing. We're looking for new clothing. The reason for this is it's a lot easier to sort and distribute new clothing than it is used clothing. And it gives these evacuees a better start having a set of brand new clothing that we can give them that's going to last longer and be easier to match with other things.
What do you see cycling through your centers that's sort of popular items, I guess, to use that term, that people might be surprised to hear about?
I don't know that it's a surprise, but the, you know, just having even things with American flags on it, people love it. They really are looking for comfortable clothing. Sweatsuits are quite popular, you know, sweatpants and sweatshirt, you know, things that you can lounge around in is really popular right now because there's a lot of time where they are kind of waiting around. So being more comfortable than fancy is definitely the way to go.
In terms of other kinds of products, do you accept donations of things like hygiene products and those sorts of things?
No, right now there isn't a need for them, okay. So we're accepting them. That is all being taken care of by the government right now and the Red Cross. So for diapers, hygiene items, all of that is really handled pretty well by Red Cross and the U.S. government partners. It is that clothing portion that we're really seeing the gap because it's such a big, big number. If you look at if there's 12,000 evacuees at Fort McCoy, just to give someone three changes of clothing, that means we need to give them, you know, we need to source 36,000 of everything, 36,000 t-shirts, 36,000 pairs of underwear, 36,000 pairs of pants, socks, underwear, shoes, jackets, hats, scarves. It really all, it's a very large number that is going to take kind of all of us working together to achieve.
Let's talk a little bit more about your organization and get a little bit more information about Team Rubicon. We're talking with John Stuhlmacher. He's the senior associate operations head there at Fort McCoy for Team Rubicon. What is Team Rubicon? How to get started?
Team Rubicon was founded by two Marine Corps veterans, Jake Wood and William McNulty, who saw the tragedies of the Haitian earthquake in 2010 and said, basically, we can't sit by. We have skills these people need. We're going to go. So they put together a team of eight who initially deployed, and they flew into the Dominican Republic and then had to cross the river to get into Haiti. And to them, that was their Rubicon. You know, after they crossed that river, the die had been cast, they burned the boats, and there was no going back. They continued on humanitarian efforts there in Haiti and then Chile, and we continued on doing international deployments as a small team for a couple of years, and then we stepped into domestic operations. And that's where Team Rubicon really started to grow. We continued to have a makeup of military veteran, first responders, and civilians, and taking all of the backgrounds and skill sets that those groups bring and really leveraging them to kick disaster in the teeth. Our gray shirts, as we call them, because we wear gray shirts, that's the most important position in Team Rubicon from the top to the bottom, is everyone's a gray shirt. And we selflessly deploy to these disaster zones, just looking to help people. And it's hard to explain to someone who hasn't done it, But the privilege it is to be able to serve someone on their worst day and make that day just a little bit better is really, really a huge thing. As we've transitioned with COVID, a lot of organizations couldn't help out with the COVID missions. And our organization from the top down said, we're going to flex in, we're going to get uncomfortable and get comfortable with being uncomfortable and do a lot of things that we never thought we were going to do. I never thought I would be planning to put volunteers in a COVID vaccination clinic, but that's something we did across the nation. Same with COVID testing. We assisted with the food shortages that were happening during COVID by putting our volunteers right into existing food banks and warehouses and supplementing their staffs. We're really looking for anywhere where there's a need. We're looking to bridge that gap and give continued service to our veterans, especially.
What circumstances brought you to Team Rubicon? How long have you been with the organization?
I've been with the organization since 2014. I didn't actually deploy till 2017 for Hurricane Harvey. It was my first actual deployment. I myself am an Army veteran. I did 9 years, one tour in Iraq, and came back, met the woman of my dreams, got married, and then we had a child on the way. And then I had to make the decision if I was going to stay in the military or get out, and I got out. And there was just always something missing. That mission was gone. And then I came onto Team Rubicon and found that mission and fell in love with it instantly. It's serving alongside other people to accomplish a good mission. And there's not much better mission than serving people in disaster times. It just really fills some of those gaps that, you know, I lost after leaving military service. And also, it's a good reality check on how, no matter how bad your life may be going, you still do have that house to go home to, unlike some of the survivors we deal with.
I saw on your website that your organization is also active on the Gulf Coast in Hurricane Ida recovery. What is it about a lot of your members having experience in the military that sets you up? Those skill sets seem to set you up well to do this kind of heavy duty logistical work.
We're used to austere environments. So that's one thing where we're coming out ahead, is that we aren't looking to set up in a hotel. We're looking for hopefully a good gym and maybe cots for people to sleep in. Our mission drive is strong in that we sometimes need to throttle back our volunteers and, you know, force them to take a break or end the day. It's that whole sense of purpose and that how you fit into the big scheme of things that really assists our people in getting the job done.
People are wondering, you know, how they can contribute, how they can get involved in the situation here. And some people hearing about your organization might be interested in how they can get involved in bigger ways. So I want to cover both of those separately. First of all, as far as the operation here at Fort McCoy with the Afghan refugees that are here in Wisconsin now, what can people do to help?
So you can go to our website, teamrubiconusa.org/resettlement. On there, it gives you a couple of different options on how you can get involved, whether you want to make a monetary contribution, if you want to sign up and get into the field. We've got an area where you can do that. We also have Amazon wish lists specific for each of the different resettlement operations we're at. And you can click on there and order some of the needed clothing items directly from your Amazon account, and it'll ship right to our facility. We'll get it sorted and distributed to the Afghan personnel. It's a pretty easy way to do it. There's also another option for just launched this week, and it's welcome.us. And this is a website that has brought together all of the organizations that are supporting this resettlement effort for the long haul. So it has what we're doing on right now, and you can get involved in that. But it even allows you to sign up and say, hey, I have jobs available for when these Afghan evacuees need a job, I'm willing to give them jobs, or I have a house that I'm willing to let them move into. It's a wide ranging platform that really is going to help support this mission as it continues on into the next stages.
And what if somebody's interest is peaked in terms of Team Rubicon itself? Either veterans or people who have just been really interested in what you had to say about your organization. Are there opportunities to join your work?
Absolutely. TeamRubiconUSA.org, and you can click right on volunteer. It's a fairly simple process. There's a little bit of training, background check, and then we can get you to the field pretty quickly. There's also a lot of specialized training that we can get into as you move through your time volunteering with us. You don't have to look at this as being a second full-time job, but you know, you want to get involved on weekends, there's ways to do that. You want to get involved in some of the disasters we're responding to remotely, we have ways to do that as well.
How do you respond to a disaster remotely? That sounds interesting.
So this was actually one of my first ways of getting engaged with the organization. A lot of times call centers are overwhelmed when there's large scale disasters, such as like Hurricane Harvey was a good example. So there's a nonprofit that's called Crisis Cleanup. And that is kind of a clearinghouse for all of the people who need help from volunteer organizations with cleanup at their property. So volunteers across the U.S. actually take the phone calls from the disaster survivors and enter that information into this system so that the responding organizations on the ground can see those work orders in real time, claim them, and get their cleanup crews to those individuals who need the help the most. So you do that from your living room in Wisconsin, and it's incredibly meaningful and it's impactful work, because every hour you're spending on the phone with the survivors equates to three more hours of work the teams in the field can get done.
That's an interesting way for an organization to be inclusive with the kinds of volunteers that they recruit too, because people, even people with mobility or accessibility issues, can participate on those different levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have many who do that.
I want to ask you about just the nature of the work that you're doing. It's the people who get these items that you're sorting, that Amazon's delivering to you, that people are donating from their local stores. For them, this is just a much needed thing. I mean, imagine wearing the same clothes for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden you have some options. And yet, when you're talking about needing like 36,000 of the same thing, there's a bit of an assembly line nature that comes into it. How do you keep in mind the personal nature of the work that you're doing when you're faced with a project that really becomes kind of a mechanized assembly line sort of effort?
Well, that's the thing, right? You've always got to tie it back to the survivors, no matter what you're doing. You know, in this case, it's the evacuees. And we in Team Rubicon have a lot of cultural things. We believe our culture is our guiding light. And one part of our culture is that we have campfires. And it's much different than a bonfire. At the end of a day's hard work, we gather around a campfire and we talk about things like that. We talk about the impact that this is making. We talk about the things that people don't necessarily get to see. And then we share our experiences and how this is affecting us, being that we have a very heavy veteran population in our organization. The fact that these are Afghanistan evacuees is very impactful for a lot of our members. And it's very important for them to know that we're still supporting our allies. And it does take an emotional toll. And it's something we need to keep thinking about, that these are not numbers. These are not people in a far off distant land. These are families of men, women, and children who had either could stay in their country or flee with nothing, not knowing where they were going to end up. And they put their faith in us as Americans to come here not knowing what was going to happen. So the fact that they did that says a lot about how they feel about America and how we should feel about ourselves, that people are willing to put that kind of trust that we're going to do the right thing.
John Stuhlmacher is with Team Rubicon, and he's helping to run their effort at Fort McCoy here in Wisconsin as they serve evacuees from Afghanistan here in our own community. John, thank you so much for sharing your perspective here on Newsmakers today.
I really appreciate you telling our story.
Absolutely. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you would like to catch part of this story that you might have missed, you can find it on our website, which is WPR.org/newsmakers. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, if you have a question or a comment or an idea you'd like to hear us explore in the future, you can email us. It's newsmakers@WPR.org. A couple of opportunities to hear our show each week. Friday mornings, our show originates at 10 o'clock on the Ideas Network 90.3. We repeat on Friday evenings at 7 o'clock on NPR News and Music 88.9. For Dawn Jewell, my producer, I'm Ezra Wall. Please join us again next week, right here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.